we can say that on a number of levels, the education system is in crisis. It's an infrastructure and a software infrastructure, so to speak, that really hasn't developed over the last 20 years, if we think in terms of primary education, when where money is constantly lacking and where teachers are concerned with the quality of education that they're having to work with in the country. That's part of the picture, but there has been progress. There has been progress largely at the upper end. And I know that this is a, if you want to say, a split view, but you do now have a good range of students who've studied abroad, who studied different languages than the usual local language and Russian. You know, the opportunity to connect with the outside world in many ways for students is greater now in Central Asia than ever before. But there's a sort of a qualification on that. That is, sometimes that can be detrimental. Sometimes they can be called back at a moment's notice, depending on a political crisis. And of course, the concern of loyalty to the state may come up if they study in a country that suddenly is not quite an ally to their state. And so these are issues that all of us in education have to worry about, but I would say we see this in Central Asia. Why do I put this as a positive? Because these very individuals who go overseas, they do pick up the ideas, they do pick up the values, they do understand at least the values expressed outside. And it's curious to see how this evolution changes over time in country. And the third good, so to speak, I would say, is existential reality. That is, we don't have to talk about, are these states surviving? Are these states really real states, which is what we did discuss 20 years ago? But rather, these are states. These are states, warts and all. They have their faults, they have their problems, they have their benefits, they have their advantages. There are states that also have choice. And this is becoming an interesting phenomenon for the rest of us to think about, and I'll get back to this a bit later. But what we're looking at today are a collection of five specific countries that you almost hate to sort of group together as one collective Central Asia that stands, because they are looking in different directions. And they're looking in different directions and starting to make choices. Which paths do we take? Which alliances do we secure? Who do we distance ourselves from? And why? We're starting to see the existential decisions, so to speak, being made in country, not somewhere else, not in Moscow, not in Washington, not elsewhere. Yes, not in Moscow, believe it or not, I think that. So these are some positive aspects. But what about the bad? The reasons for pessimism. And I can quickly note these to say, first is information access. You know, now right away, I said, wait a second, you just said education, they're exposed to all these ideas. You're right, leaving the country, they can be exposed to a wide range of ideas. Coming back home, they may find these opportunities are limited. Of course, I see this in other states as well. I do some work in the United Arab Emirates, in Turkey, and other countries, and I find that educational opportunities and sources are also limited online and in real life in libraries. But we're starting to see, of course, that information is, and the control of information is definitely seen as a priority. It also suggests that when we look at media coverage, what is said in the region isn't what we in the West, and I would say in the U.S. in particular, would understand as, so to speak, day-to-day truth. Just on a couple of quick anecdotes, during the 2008 Georgian-Russian conflict, you know, I was in Dushanbe. And it was interesting because I was getting the Russian coverage of it. And thank God those South Ossetians were saved from genocide. And that, you know, that those who wanted to foil the efforts and the evil Georgians, parenthetically stated Nazis, didn't get their way. Now, of course, when one leaves that environment and comes back and you hear the rest of the story, you realize, wait a second, I didn't quite hear the full truth on this. I didn't quite hear what was really said, what really happened. And even as complex as we want to say that that particular event was, of course we know that there are other stories at play. The same thing happened in 2010 in Bosch and Jalalabad and other events. The media coverage and the way events are analyzed are quite different than what we know and anticipate, and no surprise it causes a great distancing east and west. And I would add, one final element on this. It creates a wonderful platform and environment for conspiracy theories. In fact, it's just at my table earlier, and just telling a recent conspiracy theory that I picked up, which suggested that the development and rise of IS, the Islamic State, or Daesh, or whatever we want to call it, is actually a U.S. parentheses CIA engineered plot to target the Russian soft underbelly. Now, it's of course best exemplified by a map that I was able to pick up on this from the site that showed that if you actually combine the unrest in Nigeria, Boko Haram, the Trans-Sahel region, Libya, Yemen, of course, it all kind of leads into this wonderful direction towards Syria and Iraq. And then if you simply continue the trajectory, it lends from itself right into southern Russia. So naturally, this is all a plot to destabilize Russia, and it's a plot to destabilize Russia's allies. And this is a concern, because when you start to read this and hear this, you may sort of smile on Google and say, well, that's kind of cute, but who would believe it? Trust me, people do. In fact, I spent this past week with a group of people who truly believe these sorts of theories. Again, information access is a point that I really take to heart. Second bad element is the infrastructural environment. Now, when I said that, education has had its challenges in terms of funding, so have roads and bridges and ports and the basic infrastructure system that we see in any city, in any state. In some instances, we are still looking at Soviet-era products. Now, I say this with some caution, having to go up I-95 every day and understand that the infrastructure development in my own country sometimes is at a pretty basic rate. If anyone's not hit a pothole on the 14th Street Bridge, please raise your hand. But having said that, it's clear that if we want to build a modern Silk Road, a new Silk Road, or whatever Silk Road we call it, real infrastructural development has to take place. It can't just be planned. It has to actually happen. Now, there are companies and there are governments that are interested in this, but this is going to take a multi-billion dollar effort to truly modernize the infrastructure so it can compete and equate with the neighboring states. And finally, the last bad point, so to speak, it's about politics. Let's throw this one out. The political environment has increasingly changed, and I don't think we outsiders have quite kept up in understanding it. Now, some, in fact, at my table, a couple of people definitely have, and I look forward to hearing them this morning. But I will say that when we look at the leadership structures, power dynamics, we see a shift taking place from, obviously, we still want to say an older Soviet-era model to something else. Now, for 20 years, we tried, many efforts to democratize, to create political party systems, open media, et cetera, et cetera. I confess I was part of a number of these efforts as well. They almost all failed. And the question is why? Did they fail because we moved too quickly? Did they fail because we didn't listen? Did they fail because there were attractive alternatives? And in many ways, each of these is part of the truth. There's also, I think, part of this failure and part of this inability to change the political systems, a hubris that developed on our side after the Cold War. Whether we called it the unipolar moment or the end of history, we felt that, we'll help them as a victor would help the vanquished. We made comparisons to Germany and Japan at the end of World War II. And in fact, we treated this as a victory worthy of the most obnoxious end zone victory dance or celebration. And from our side, that made sense. From the other side, not just the Russian perspective, but the Central Asian, the Ukrainian, the Moldovan, and anyone else, it was insulting. And we didn't quite get it. And so no surprise when we tried to impose, and I'll use that word, a particular view on politics, party formation, etc., we met with resistance and ultimately with results probably not to our liking. And what hurts even more is the sense that today, when you look at the term democracy, it usually equates with chaos. And when you look at the term free market, it usually equates with the term kleptocracy. This is not what we intended, but obviously this is something that has happened in the region and something that needs to change. So, a couple of pessimistic comments. To close then, what are some worst-case scenarios or best-case scenarios or things to look at in the future if we want to say what's the ugly? What are some of the things that we want to sort of sink our teeth in and really talk about, which we can do this morning and really, quite frankly, as the day goes on? Well, first is going to be about politics again. It's about succession. It's about leadership transition. Now, the usual worry here is a leader eventually passes on and there'll be chaos, confusion, civil war will break out, and we see these things happen in other parts of the world. We also see in other parts of the world, and we've already seen in Central Asia, a leader passes on, the other leaders get together, make a decision, and a legitimacy is somehow conferred upon this new individual. That's a papal model of succession for sure, but it works. Is it democratic? Not necessarily. Does it create stability? In the short run, yes. In the long term, let's wait and see. But we have to imagine, of course, that succession and that leadership transitions inevitably have to take place. Actuary tables don't lie. People do pass on. And we will have to think in terms of how can these transitions take place. We don't have a large end. We have, what, three coups, if we want to call it that. We have one death in office and one electoral transition. Not a lot to work on in over 20 years. But one expects that these are things that are going to come in the coming years. Second issue that is going to come up that we need to pay attention to, the infiltration of radical ideas. Now, I mentioned the sort of conspiracy theories about Daesh or IS. We can get more sinister. I actually do think that this is a concern in the region. Now, we can look at all the statistics on the number of Central Asians and Russians and those from the Caucasus, etc., who are migrating to the Islamic State and fighting the good fight. And yes, there are more from Western Europe and other countries at the moment, no question. And yes, finally, we can say that most of these are actually coming not directly from the region, but as guest workers in Russia, unable to find employment. And quite frankly, it's incredibly easy to get a flight from Moscow to Istanbul. And then once you get to Istanbul, you can vanish. And you can cross the border. It's quite open. So, why is this a concern? Because in the past, when we had extremist groups and threats, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, Adalat, among others, they were very specific. They, in fact, were very simple in their approaches. Their multimedia campaign was primitive. Their recruitment policies were amateurish to okay. And ultimately, they didn't meet with much success. And not even just that they were defeated on the battlefield at times or apprehended after attacks, but that they didn't really gain much popular support. This new effort is something different, and it taps into a frustration and an angst that we find among different communities and constituencies, and not just in Uzbekistan or Tajikistan. We find it in North Dakota and Manchester and other places as well. We find this concern of, hey, I'm going to gravitate to this new group, and I would encourage anyone to take a quick peek at some of these sites, not on your government computer if you're a government employee, but do it on your personal one, or better yet, on somebody else's, so they can pick up the virus. And you'll find that it's actually quite sophisticated. It's quite appealing, actually. And you could see, for somebody who was really distraught and concerned, this is an avenue. Now, the immediate reaction to this is, oh, you're overblowing it, because, of course, it's now the thing that's on 24/7 on CNN and all the news channels, right? Well, yes and no. Perhaps we are exaggerating this threat, but let's be blunt. A year ago, we didn't really even talk about its existence, 2 years ago, for sure. And so we're still in that process of understanding what this new entity is. And when you have individuals in Afghanistan, when you have Taliban groups actually swearing allegiance, this is an interesting challenge. The final, what to look for in the future, and this is an issue that I hope we address in the final panel on security, is I still worry, I do worry a lot, but I still worry that We remain in the state where we're instrumentalizing central Asia. Outsiders in particular, but even in the region, we still tend to think of things in terms of bargains that can be hammered out for specific end states and then dispensed with when that end state is over. Of course, the classic example, which will be written on, I think, for years to come, is the security relationship the U.S. had with several Central Asian states from 2001 to 2014. We looked at the region through the lens of Afghanistan, and we looked at the region through the lens of helping us achieve a security objective in Afghanistan. We didn't really care about Central Asia in and of itself. Now, some individuals did, and I'm really proud to know these people, but quite frankly, a number of folks simply said, hey, we have to check some blocks, we need to take care of things in Afghanistan, and now that that dynamic is over, and I should say over, yes, Resolute Support Mission is there, yes, there are U.S. troops there, but this transit route through Central Asia is not required, it's making us rethink the region. For example, the Manas Transit Center closed last year, as bases closed worldwide. Does this mean that Kyrgyzstan is less important to the U.S. than it was, say, a year or two ago? Absolutely. Absolutely. In terms of our policy and in terms of our security interests, Kyrgyzstan has really dropped quite low. And in fact, some could suggest or argue that we may even have a punitive policy. Kyrgyzstan wants to shut our base down? Great. Let's cut off ties with them, or let's reduce aid to them, to let them know that we mean business, and that wasn't a good thing to do. It's just a suggestion. Could we improve ties with other states? Absolutely. But to what end? And this now becomes a challenge in the region, and I would say in the U.S. government, but also in European governments, is as we look at this region, are we continuing to think of it in terms of how is it affecting something else? How are we using it to block out Russia? Are we using it to block out China? Or if I'm in Moscow, am I forging ties in Central Asia to block out the U.S., to prevent other countries from engaging in the region? It's one thing to look at national interests. It's another thing to play at this like a fifth-grade playground. And unfortunately, I still think that when we look at Central Asia, we have that latter quality. Now, the challenge, I would say, for us in particular, and here I'll kind of put on the U.S. hat for just a moment, is what is our policy and what is our interest towards Central Asia? We've gone through different stages. You know, we've gone through the post-Soviet, let's create independent states, let's support them, let's democratize, let's create free market economies, let's focus on human rights. We've looked at energy, let's diversify their energy routes. We've looked at security. It's 2015. What next? Do we simply rehash old ideas and reprioritize them? Or do we look at new ideas, new approaches? Or do we even rethink our role in this region? Which is a hard thing to do, to say maybe we are not first among equals or even just among equals, but maybe we're simply an accessible partner that can play a key role when needed. This is a challenge for our folks at State Department, and I'm really happy that Dick Hoagland is speaking here at lunch, who can enlighten us further on these issues, and I know that this is a topic that we'll look at later today. Well, I've kind of the list of thoughts, and you can jot them all down, they're three threes if you want to think in terms of Chinese philosophy, but what does all this mean? Well, first of all, each of these topics is worthy of further discussion. And there are a host of other topics that could be raised. Yes, I didn't touch on a number of things, and perhaps we can raise some of these right now. But I hope that they've been able to spark a little interest in thinking about our region. I should also stress that the current trajectories are not set in stone, and I refuse to believe in some sort of inevitable fate. Looking at other nations around the world over the past quarter century, it's clear that changes can happen, and sometimes in rather radical and unexpected ways. Whether it's a Myanmar suddenly opening up-ish, whether it is a Yemen suddenly collapsing, well, for the fourth time this decade. But states can go through changes, and we have to adjust to these. And again, in unexpected ways. And so when we say Central Asia, what next, the topic of this conference, well, that, quite frankly, is an incredibly interesting question. And I look forward to having us examine this as the day goes on. I thank you for your time and your attention.
Thank you very much, Roger. That was a brilliant tour d'horizon. I'm going to ask you the first question, and then we will open it up. So I want to come to the ugly part one, which has to do with succession, but more probably broadly with domestic politics. You said, you talked about really the failure of U.S. policy in the region to sort of promote the kinds of political and economic developments that we wanted to. How much influence do you think the two other major, I guess, outside players, Russia and China, have on domestic developments in this region?
No, that's an excellent question. And I should... No, because as I was going through this, in my mind I'm thinking, you know, I actually am an optimist. It doesn't show. I'm a Cubs fan, so yay. But I really was coming across as a Debbie Downer. So I thinking, well, gee, how can I now get back to optimism? I can't. So I'll get to the point about the other factors. I do think there are influences, less so Russia, more so China. China has a very interesting engagement program, and it's not just sort of this broader OSF effort, and a number of folks actually in this room have written on that, but it's also an interesting template or model of non-interference in domestic affairs of neighboring states, first and foremost. That's a wonderful policy. When they conduct security cooperation with the state, it's almost in contrast to how we do it. We will say, hey, we want to conduct a program with you, whether it's in security or education or economics, you name it. But first, here are 17 preconditions we want to discuss, and here's a number of factors that we really want to make clear you need to worry about or think about or sign off on. We front-load our problems. The Chinese, quite frankly, don't do that. It's very much a, hey, we want to cooperate, wonderful, here's a check. But I call it the Don Corleone school of bargaining, which is, a day may come where I may need your assistance, and when that day comes, I will come to your door. And I do worry, and Turkmenistan's a good example, where they've signed off on some interesting gas deals. Somewhere down the road, there's going to be a payback that, unfortunately, the Turkmen may not like, but they are going to be obligated to fulfill. And so, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, in the short run, they do provide an interesting model. And I would also say that there's a... it's a challenge that when we, the West, and again, I'm rather critical of the West in doing this, but when we were looking at these reform policies, and I remember working on some campaign efforts in both Russia and in Central Asia, where, you know, it's actually, let's teach candidates how to campaign for office. And to think that we would actually impose, you know, 1992 or 94 U.S. onto a completely alien system was a bit much, and there probably should have been, in retrospect, should have been, an understanding of the local culture and dynamics. Quite frankly, what we did in countries like Japan, which had a democratic tradition, but also had a very sort of pronounced, distinct culture, and that's a post-World War II victor-vanquished relationship. We actually, I think, had greater respect for Japanese culture and traditions than we did sometimes in the post-Soviet space. And so that caused problems. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to field your own questions?
Sir. Or
thank you, Jeff Goldstein from the Open Society Foundations. Roger, I just wanted to throw one more thing onto your list. The director of our foundation from Dushanbe was here right after the elections. And interestingly, they didn't want to talk about the elections. All they wanted to talk about was the economic situation, in particular the impact of what's going on in Russia. And they're looking at a country with 57% of GDP from remittances. Mm-hmm. Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, not far behind. Precipitous fall already, but even more scary for them, they're beginning to see people come back from Russia, which didn't even happen in 2008. And I think this is important also because it brings up your question of the instrumentalization of Central Asia, because I'm sure no one thought about this when the policy of sanctioning Russia was put out. And yet, listening to the Russian TV, as you were doing, and people are in this region, they're hearing that all of this is because of the United States. So, comment rather than a question.
Okay. No, and actually it's one, just as a kind of a quick follow-up on that. That dynamic of the and the concern of the economic collapse, and particularly the country you mentioned, but even in some of the neighboring ones, is there similar things that I hear. And the blame is placed squarely on, and it's even a case of the U.S. more so than the Europeans. The narrative is the Europeans want to lift the sanctions, the Americans don't. And it almost becomes a let's further target the U.S., which is, you're right, problematic.
Of America. Roger, can you think of any options that you think that U.S. has that it hasn't tried? Because any U.S. official would tell you, we've done that, we've tested that, that approach didn't work. And they may also tell you that, frankly, we have not been overloading countries of Central Asia with a lot of conditions lately. So anything that you could suggest that we could try?
Okay. Actually, yes. Sort of a simple approach, which is we're trying too hard. We're like a really bad first date that's gone on for 20-some years. And we want them to love us. We're kind of the Sally Fields, right, of the world. And that gets to be overkill. And actually, on a serious note on this, because we come across now, and this is no shock. I mean, public opinion after public opinion, and often Western engineered public opinions. This is not sort of local twists on things, if you want to say, even worry about that. Note that the perception issues of our policies vis-a-vis the region is negative. We're seen as boorish, as bullying. I would even say in our embassies, and this is a challenge I know that a lot of our embassy officials have, they're not able to really even go out and meet people, talk to people. They're busy sort of working in their isolated zone of the embassy compound. The expat community is equally isolated, much less than it was in the past. I know there are security concerns and security issues, and quite frankly, a lot of busy days. But what we failed to do is really have a better understanding of the situation on the ground and an understanding of what are perhaps those two or three things that we can work on. And really leave it at that. And it's not to say vanish. I'm not suggesting withdrawal from the region, to hell with it, we don't need it. I mean, for a lot of us in the room, we devote our lives to this, to better understanding U.S. Central Asian ties or interest in the region. But I think it has to be done on a more limited basis, and at least start going back to that adage of, start for the areas where you can get decent cooperation between the partners. And yes, you have to deal with the hard issues as well. You can't just ignore them. But this also entails an investment, and it entails an investment in time and people. And usually at some point I have to make a plug, but this is one where I always feel committed to doing this. We have to invest in education on our side. We have to invest in the people who study the region. We have to invest in the future people who will study the region. So we can have a better handle on what's going on. Now, the curious thing is we actually have a good cadre in the U.S. of people who know more than just Central Asia, post-Soviet space, and think in terms of that. A very nuanced, refined, and I would say intellectually creative approach to the region. We need to hear these voices. And so there's a lot of, I think, ways where we can do this that are at low cost. I deal with budgets every day, and I'm constantly thinking, okay, how much can we do it for less? Well, we can do it for less. We don't have to go in with huge, expansive programs. It can often just be, we're present, we can listen, we can be partners. The people who are going to come in with the massive engagement programs are already there. China's going to outspend us no matter how we try to combat that. Russia, we'll see how much they can spend, but most definitely through the Eurasian Economic Union, we're going to see a relationship that's going to become very interesting and I think very tight in the coming years. And so we simply need to be an opportunity there, not necessarily one that's driving a specific agenda. Thoughts? Oh, come on, it's morning.
Okay.
Any skinny on the election results in Uzbekistan?
What?
Any skinny on the election results in Uzbekistan?
Say it again.
Have you heard anything about the election results in
Uzbekistan? Election results. Actually, I have not, simply because I was out of the country till the other day, and so I am behind. So I could give you a fabricated answer, but I'm going to actually have to say I haven't heard really anything insightful in them other than what's been sort of published in your basic media.
Well, maybe to add to that, so if, as we are to believe, that President Primov, let's say, gets, say, 90% of the vote or maybe more, what does that tell us going forward? Just more of the same in Uzbekistan? I mean, what is the, you know...
My concern, and this is where I'll get to an opinion element to that, my concern is that we're defaulting to no other alternative, that the effort to seriously look at alternatives isn't being explored right now, and it's being pushed back to the latest possible moment. Now, I will make one other confession, of course, as a Chicagoan, I grew up during the era of Richard J. Daley, and in terms of Chicago mayordoms, this was a regime that looks scarily familiar. And it was one, quite frankly, when it was over, it was over. That is, when he passed on. There was a quick scramble for successors, and it was a pretty weak field, that no successor really had been groomed. Now, this is, of course, in a nice, simple, safe urban setting in the U.S. When we look at national settings in areas that are rather contentious or problematic, it does raise concerns for all of the countries in the region. Not that there has to be the same 24/7, you know, presidential media coverage that we see here in the U.S., right, where almost everything is cast in terms of 2016 candidates, and we're going to get this for the next 18 months or so. But there ought to be some thought given to options. There ought to be some thought given to open debate and discussion about what's next. And I know because you have systems where you have a fairly strong leader, people are reluctant to do that. And people are also reluctant to stick their neck out to be that person, to be that alternative, because, of course, there could be repercussions. One can go back to their old editions of Moral Fame Side, and you realize that the dynamics in many ways haven't progressed beyond what folks were familiar with years back. And so that does worry me. You know, that there is a popularity, that there is an election, and it takes place, and that we have a continuation of the regime, got it. That happens worldwide. But my worry is, well, after this, are we really preparing for something else? Or are we going to have this, you know, death in office, and then a caucus of key leaders, and then somebody else put up that the population is going to grudge and we have to accept? And that, I hope, is not the course of action.
Thank you. I'm Sarah Freese. I'm a Series MA candidate this year, and also with U.S. House of Business Association. I guess I'm asking under my student hat. Wondering, speaking of the EU, what you think the implications of that are for interregional dynamics and relations moving forward, as new countries are deciding whether or not to join, and others are essentially not going to. Thank you.
Okay. Now, this is actually, in fact, in speaking with Russian colleagues and Russian friends about this, it's fascinating, because I get you're overblowing the importance of the EU. It's not what you think. It's not going to be this controlling, manipulating structure that will have Russia dominating its neighboring states. And yet everything suggests that that's a path that at least certain people in Moscow would like it to go. I think the EU, first of all, we are going to have an expansion in Central Asia, and we are going to see Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan as members. Kazakhstan already is. In Kazakhstan, there's a healthy debate of whether it's actually beneficial or not. Will it open up certain markets? You know very well the challenges it provides now for Kazakh businesses, Kazakh firms. So we're going to see this work itself out. I mean, you have a disproportionate percentage of the economy, obviously, in one state, in this rather, I would say, structured economic union. It's not like the European Union, where you have it fairly diffused, or at least where there are a couple of poles of major players, you know, France, Italy, Germany, if you think of the early European economic community. So we're already stuck with a lopsided structure that I would argue is going to be detrimental to the junior partners in it, in that arrangement, unless they can have certain opt-outs or certain opportunities to trade outside. And this gets to your point about regional trade. The other two countries, I'm highly doubtful, will become members. Uzbekistan, quite frankly, is taking a course of action that I find is logical. They can trade with these partners, but to become part of the EEU would curtail Uzbek economic sovereignty, which is something that they hold rather dear. Turkmenistan technically could be part of it, even though it's positive, you know, has a positive neutrality policy. This is not a security structure, but they're not going to join, and they're busy looking southward in other directions. And so I actually see in some ways, unfortunately, a process where we could look at three states quasi-integrated in a Russian-dominated matrix, and the other two states starting to look in other directions, and intra-regional, intra-Central Asian trade actually being stymied. Yes, we could see some trade routes, and you would see the major border posts or the major crossing points, you know, the Uzbek-Kazakh border, you know, being one. You know, you're going to see Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, I think, looking elsewhere, rightfully so, and finding opportunities elsewhere. If we have an Iran sanctions deal somehow struck in the next hours, day, in the next 28 hours or so, you know, maybe we could see even opening up in that direction, southward to Afghanistan, Pakistan, you name it. I mean, India's making inroads into the region, and we definitely like to trade, and you would start to see two different tracks. And so I actually see it as sort of a quasi-split. Now, having said that, in Europe, you don't really see the presence of the EU being so detrimental to the non-EU states. But that's also, it's a multi-state diversified structure where there are opportunities for all present. So, you know, in some ways it would be great if that would be the solution in Central Asia. That may be a bit too far. So some general thoughts.
Right. Please join me in thanking Professor Candice for
absolutely.